Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Today marks the second day that Israeli soldiers have been forcibly evicting settlers from Gaza and the West Bank. Protests are continuing in the settlements of Kfar Daram and Neve Dekalim, where earlier today Israeli soldiers entered a synagogue to remove some 1,500 protesters. Anne Bernard is a reporter with the Boston Globe. I spoke with her a short while ago as she stood outside the synagogue in Neve Dekalim.
Hi, Frank. At the synagogue, lines of soldiers are guarding the area, and soldiers are going in and escorting individual protesters out. And it's a remarkable image because the girls in the synagogue are all the same age as the soldiers that are walking them out with their arms around their shoulders, like girls walking down a high school hallway. Now I'm at the house of a family, one of the last families to be evacuated. It's a doctor who's worked here for 16 years. And the soldiers had to break down the doors. Then once they were inside, they prayed together, and the commander of the soldiers cried and said that he too is a father. This doctor has 9 children. The commander cried and said he has children and he loves Israel and he's carrying out his mission.
And you say they prayed together before this began, before they took them out.
They prayed together after they take the door down and before, in fact, I'm watching right now as they're getting ready to carry the family out, 21 family members and many friends.
And has much changed now in the second day of this forced removal?
I think that they've tackled the tougher places now, the families that were more determined to stay, the protesters, and at the same time you're also seeing some resolution because you're seeing these scenes of crying and agreement. But it doesn't mean that the wound is healed because this family, as they said they would forgive the soldiers, they also lectured them on how ultimately this was their choice to participate.
Do you get a sense from those who remain now that anyone is going to change tactics? It has been so far peaceful. Any sense the tactics may change?
Where I am now, the sense is that they just want to finish this, making their stand, but in a peaceful way. In some other towns, as I understand it, that may not be the case.
You said that you've been following a family and that family has just been removed. Where are they going?
I'm literally watching them come out the door right now. I don't know where they're going.
Have they talked to you about their plans after this?
They haven't made plans as part of their protest.
Do you know how many people remain in Neve Dekalim?
I believe it's less than 100. It was only about 120 by the end of yesterday. And now they've taken out many more people today.
So this operation will probably be complete by later today then?
That's what they expect.
Anne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anne Bernard is a reporter with the Boston Globe. She joined us outside a synagogue in Neve Dekalim in Gaza. The death toll continues to rise in Iraq. Nearly 50 people have been killed since yesterday, including 4 U.S. soldiers earlier today. The rising violence in Iraq underscores the difficulty of reconstructing the country after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Efforts to draft a new constitution are on hold as the leaders of Iraq's main factions try to work out their differences. So far, they've made little visible progress toward resolving the country's deep divisions. The process unfolding in Iraq is remarkably similar to a scenario played out several decades ago. It was England's idea, after World War I, to turn the various ethnic and religious groups that inhabited the region into a nation-state. But the idea was never embraced by the people who lived there. Joining us to discuss the history of modern Iraq is Sarah Shields, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Professor Shields, welcome.
Thank you.
The situation in Iraq has some precedent in recent history. Tell us about the origins of modern Iraq.
Iraq was part of the Ottoman Empire, of course, before World War I. And after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire was defeated, the League of Nations, which was brand new at the time, decided to turn the countries of the Middle East into separate nation states. But the Ottoman Empire wasn't a consistent kind of state. It was multilingual and multi-ethnic and multi-religious, and actually functioned fairly successfully to keep very diverse people together in the same polity.
Let's talk a little bit about that. How did the Turks keep order without these sort of national divisions that England and I guess now the U.S. seems to think are important?
Well, it's really interesting that the Ottoman Empire wasn't really Turks. It was a multinational, multi-ethnic elite, even, with many of the sultans, the rulers themselves, being the sons of Christian women, concubines, slave women, and people from various parts of the empire, not necessarily Turks, who were in charge. The notion that one can only rule over a nation state is really kind of a phenomenon just of the last 200 years. Before that, rulers ruled over people that weren't defined nationally. So it's not that these people aren't national the way we think of as singular linguistic areas, but that doesn't seem to me to be relevant. Switzerland has four linguistic areas, and the government there doesn't seem to have trouble ruling it.
Well, what was the value then? What were the British trying to do?
I think what the British were trying to do was create a state that would be able to become part of, initially, the British Empire. The reason the British were so interested in Iraq was because it controlled the route to India. And it was only after the British lost India that they were willing to give up Iraq and Palestine at the same time. But it's fascinating to me that the British, who initially went into Iraq during World War I simply to defend their route to India, end up staying and trying to retain control over this very oil-rich area, partly because of their need for resources, partly to maintain this route to India. But they only decide to make it an independent state when the people of Iraq rise up against their presence.
So what was the value there? Was there something about, were they trying to create divisions or trying to create unity?
Well, what they were trying to do was create stability, and it didn't really matter so much whether it was divided or unified, as long as it was stable. What they decided to do, because there was this tremendous outpouring of opposition to the British presence, was to pull their troops back and create a kingdom that technically Iraqis would be in charge of. But behind every Iraqi, there was a British manager or a political officer. So even after Iraq technically becomes independent in the 1920s, the British still retain control over the economy, the foreign policy, and military, the security. They retain Royal Air Force bases right up through the 1950s.
And, well, did this mollify the Iraqi people?
Well, it stabilizes the situation to the point that the British can rule through an Iraqi elite. And as people get more and more angry about it, it takes more and more harder efforts to keep the population under control until finally in 1958 there's a coup and the whole government changes. And at that point, Britain loses all of its power over Iraq for the next couple of decades.
Do you think it makes sense now to try to forge a nation out of these factions that we see struggling in Iraq today?
See, ironically, I think that after the British left, there came to be something that people recognized as an Iraqi nation. For example, we talk now a lot about the Sunni and Shia divisions in Iraq. But on the other hand, there's been tremendous amounts of intermarriage. Most of the tribal groups even have representatives of both major religious groups in them. It's really interesting that during the Iran-Iraq War, despite Saddam Hussein's expulsion of many Shiites, the overwhelming number of people in the army were Shiite who fought against Shi'i Iran. People in Iran, in Iraq, even the Shiites, fought on behalf of the country of Iraq for a long time. So at some point, some entity of Iraq has come into existence. And I think that what we see as the beginnings of a massive civil war were actually perhaps underlying tensions, but certainly exacerbated by the policies of the current administration in the U.S.
So do you think then that the divisions that we're seeing, the tensions that we're seeing, are more a function of the U.S. presence and not so much a question of whether or not Iraq was ready to be what we consider a modern nation state?
Oh, I think Iraq actually had become a modern nation state. There were things like when the Iraqi police forces, military forces, who were overwhelmingly Shiite, came in to fight against Fallujah and destroyed the city and the population. Fallujah was overwhelmingly Sunni, and that sort of thing certainly exacerbates tensions that always existed, but because Iraq had been a secular state, were definitely in the background.
Well, this whole question of trying to forge a nation state, and of course, as you say, Iraq had become one, in the age of transnational power structures, raises another question. The fall of Saddam, of course, comes as we see a rise in world powers that ignore traditional national boundaries. World businesses are carried out by transnational corporations. Terrorist networks don't really see themselves as having state capital. The internet has formed nations of people who aren't nationalities. So I'd like to keep you on the line, Sarah, as we now turn to Professor Saskia Sassen and talk about transnationals and whether the trend is away from the whole concept of the nation state. Saskia Sassen is the head of the University of Chicago's Transnational Project. Professor Sassen, welcome.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm fine. It seems that there is a sort of confluence of transnational forces in Iraq today. Who are the major players?
Well, you have the corporations who more or less own most of the resources. You have the emerging sort of diasporic networks with the professionals who are leaving now because of the instability and those who left throughout the Saddam Hussein years. And you have a variety of other forces which on some level make Iraq a very special case. The larger Arab nation, the larger nation of Islam, the Iran-Iraq connections. So it does, in fact, make you think that Iraq is a spot that is traversed by many, many cross-border entities.
We are talking about the condition of Iraq as it tries to put together a new constitution in the context of a growing trend toward transnationalism. Corporations whose dollars ignore international borders, terrorist groups who do the same, and a whole internet nation of nations. My guests are Sarah Shields, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Professor Saskia Sassen, head of the University of Chicago's Transnational Project. Our conversation continues on Here and Now. Stay with us. We're talking about transnational powers and the future of Iraq today. Sarah Shields is one of my guests, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Professor Saskia Sassen is head of the University of Chicago's Transnational Project. Professor Saskia, before the break, we were talking about the power and the influence of transnational organizations, those that don't really recognize formal borders. And I'm thinking with no permanent government in place yet in Iraq, the impact must have magnified. Let's take a look at the terror networks and how the profile they've taken on in Iraq.
Right, but I do think I would agree completely with Susan that one of the critical sources we need to recognize in terms of the instabilities and even the opening up of to terrorists, international foreign terrorists, is the fact of the military presence of the United States. I don't think that's a big elephant right there in front of us that we cannot leave out. However, having said that, it is clear that thanks to the United States government, we now do have an internationalizing of the insurgency, the term usually used for this. Some will say terrorists. So it is an issue. There is no doubt about it. And not that it's going to be another Afghanistan, because the system is simply far more complex here than it was in Afghanistan. But it is certainly happening. Now, I think that terrorist networks, of course, are to be found. They're multi-sited, and they're to be found in many places. The, as has been reported in the news extensively, the extraordinary instability that the military occupation contributes to does create a very thriving environment for certain kinds of terrorist elements. There is no doubt, and there are evidently growing numbers, though the numbers are still small, coming from the outside.
I'm wondering, too, that if some of these trends don't point to an even larger question, which is, you know, are we seeing the obsolescence of the state?
Yeah, well, I think that, not of governments. You know, I think that Iraq has a government. It's sort of in the making, and it will have a government, you know, over the next decade, let's say. The big question is, will it be a nation state the way we conceive of it, you know, through our European history? And here I want to make 2 points. One is that each of the European states struggled enormously. Mm-hmm. Many of them were multinations. You know, they had the equivalent of the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurdish regions in Iraq today. And it took centuries sometimes to construct those nations. So that we need to also have keep that in mind with Iraq. A lot of attention has gone to the notion that with so many internal differences and such passions around each of these differences, you know, how can they constitute a nation state? So on the one hand, most of the European countries had a long time, and the United States. It took quite a bit here, too, in a way.
Not to mention the Civil War to resolve some of the biggest issues.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, the second point is one that does pick up on what you are signaling, is why should the nation state, as we have known it, especially over the last 100 years, be around forever? I frankly, in my own research, I find that increasingly the state is a very elaborate and complex sort of administrative capability, but increasingly denationalized. And here certainly globalization has played a role. So no matter the rhetorics of the nation and the renationalizing of identities faced with immigration and now faced with terrorism that we hear in Europe, that we hear in the United States, still our national state is no longer quite what it was because of all these issues that you have raised. In that sense, one is almost tempted to launch a wild thesis, and it is a bit wild, and to say to what extent Iraq, which is an acute case of a whole bunch of things, might actually represent the very violent birth of a new notion of a nation state, you know, where the nation state is not quite the operative
right
term. But again, that would be an extreme condition.
Well, let me go to Sarah Shields at the University of North Carolina and get your take on this. Is this, could this be the signal that we're headed towards some other way of social and political organization?
Well, I think it's a really fascinating question, and one of the advantages about being a historian is that we don't actually have to predict the future. We can just sort of
predict
look
at the past. Yeah.
We can just sort of look at the recent past. I'm fascinating listening to the talk about something after the nation state. It seems that when we talk about the Middle East, we increasingly see that the biggest function of the nation state government, that being sovereignty, is being willingly given up by many parts of the world. I live in North Carolina, which is obviously the home of Jesse Helms for a very long time, and my students recognize the problems with the United Nations that he talked about. One of the big problems with the United Nations, with NAFTA, with CAFTA, with GATT, is that the U.S. is willing to give over sovereignty in certain small areas. And there are still people in North Carolina that find that really horrific. And there are some of us who think it's a great idea. But the idea that we have an old-style nation state with sovereignty over all of our laws and all of our trade and all of our military is no longer accurate even here. So talking about how we're on the edge of a brave new world, which is going to be post-national, seems kind of like an old debate when we have the European Union that's trying to break down those in Europe, and we have subnational groups like the Kurds and the Basques who are still demanding their own entities.
Sure, but very briefly, in the short time that I have left, what kind of picture does that create once, you know, it seems that if a nation state is more or less irrelevant, dollars travel where they want, terrorist groups operate where they want, do we even talk about the United States of America?
I think that as a historian and an idealist, what I think we should be looking toward is the kind of political entity that will guarantee human rights and political rights around the globe. And one of the big problems with our idealization of the nation state and the kind of empires that nation states in the past have constructed is that those can take away, and historically have taken away, both human rights and political rights. So one of the things that I think we need to think about is this constitution is being trumped so much in Iraq, is that constitutions don't bring democracy. There are democracies without constitutions, and that elections are not what provides human rights. Lots of elected governments with constitutions don't recognize human rights.
I'm afraid that
would be the way I would want to focus
and
what
I'm
happens next.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to say goodbye, but I do appreciate it. Sarah Shields, Associate Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Professor Saskia Sassen, Head of the University of Chicago's Transnational Project. Thanks very much for being with us. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
The credibility of the 9/11 Commission is now in question, with reports that the Commission refused to include information from a Special Forces military unit that identified Mohammed Atta as a member of an al-Qaeda cell long before the attacks took place. Some Commission staffers say the information was not included because it was not significant. Pentagon's not disputing the claims and says an investigation is underway. Joining us on the line is Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who is the first U.S. military officer to publicly discuss his association with the Special Forces so-called Able Danger Unit. Colonel Schaefer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Frank.
What was the now disbanded Able Danger Special Forces Unit? What'd you do?
Well, I was actually in charge of a sister special mission unit nicknamed Stratus Ivy. It was actually my unit, my task force, which was asked by General Schoomaker, the then four-star commander of Special Operations Command, to provide assistance and support, somewhat specialized, in some cases still classified, to assist the Able Danger effort getting up and running and then providing a full range of support to make sure that they were able to do their mission, which essentially was very simply to target globally the al-Qaeda organization.
And you use something we now call data mining, right? Tell us a bit about that.
That is correct. That was kind of the start point. That data mining, essentially, in the case of Able Danger, was to take about 2.5 terabytes of information, look through that, rack it and stack it using advanced algorithms, looking for patterns and clusters of relationships and linkages.
And doing that, you found out that Mohammed Atta was a pretty bad agent and a member of an al-Qaeda cell.
Well, the answer is, yeah, we didn't know how bad he was. The thing we did know from the software, and again, we're looking forward to some of the folks who actually did the technical part of this coming forward and talking in greater detail to provide the full detail, is essentially we linked these guys to the al-Qaeda leadership, and that was of grave concern.
And you went to the FBI with this information, or tried to,
right?
And well, tell us a little bit about that. How
sure.
far did you get with the information?
Problem became is that I tried to establish the linkages, the meetings, and within the Able Danger Project, there were there was a call by the leadership, as I'm told by one of the officers who will eventually come out here and be able to talk about it. Internally, the lawyers recommended against it for several reasons, and the leadership of that era within the chain of command. And let me be very clear on this: we don't believe the information ever got to General Schoomaker, the commanding general. We believe there was some level of cutting the information off from him. Anyway, the decision was made by the chain of command below General Schoomaker to not share that information.
So for a variety of reasons, the information doesn't get through before the 9/11 attacks. Now comes a commission that's looking into what went wrong,
mm-hmm.
and you go to them and you say, hey, you know, we had some stuff and it didn't get through. Maybe you need to investigate this. What happened then?
Well, I was deployed running the Defense Human Operations in Afghanistan in the fall of 2003, when we were told by our chain of command that Dr. Zelikow and his staff, Dr. Zelikow being the senior executive director of the 9/11 Commission staff, was going to be in town, and does anybody have information that may be relevant to pre-9/11 counterterrorism activities? I raised my hand, got permission from the chain of command, and again, the chain of command validated what I was going to say. Basically, I told them what I was going to say, and they said, yes, that needs to be given to them. I go in and sit down with Dr. Zelikow, two staffers, and a lawyer, and I don't remember all of their names, unfortunately. But what I do remember is I discussed in detail the information I'm providing you. I kind of went through a who shot John of all the details. to include letting them know that it was my understanding, based on the information that we had, we discovered two of the three cells, that is, that people who populated, you know, not all of them, but, you know, we discovered through these four individuals, essentially two of the three cells which conducted 9/11. And as I recall, I mentioned Mohammed Atta as well. And again, I'm going off the notes, the talking points I made at the time. What was significant to me, both then and now, is that at the end of the meeting, Dr. Zelikow provided me his card and said, you know, we need to continue this dialogue. After I'd given him about an hour and a quarter spiel on this, he said, we need to continue this. So he gave me his card and asked me to please contact him upon my return from Afghanistan. Fast forward then to January of 2004. I've returned. I'm back on duty. I call his number. The staffer says, yeah, we remember you. We want to talk to you. A week goes by. They don't call me. I call back, and I get the great brush off. And I had to assume that at the point in time that someone with similar information to me, and again, I had to assume that I'm not the only one that knows this. I believe that someone else had come forward and provided similar information.
So then the report comes out, and it turns out it's none of this is in the report, and the commission members themselves say they never got this information either. Were you surprised?
Well, I was shocked when they first did denial, but if you read their last statement, they changed their tune all last week.
Well, you're raising this. I want to point this out because there's some question about the credibility of the data you brought to them, which is why the commission staff says we didn't pass it on because it didn't all check out. Some of the things he was saying didn't check out with other information.
That's correct, and that's where, you know, there are some issues with that. My colleague, the Navy officer who's been talked about in the press, also provided them the same information, and his credibility was called into question, too. My problem with that, Frank, is to be totally direct, is I don't believe they asked for everything. I offered up during my meeting in October a full set of the Able Danger documents that I had in my possession. I talked recently to the officer who actually handled what DOD passed over to the 9/11 Commission, and essentially this officer passed two briefcase-size containers over to them. And I can tell you we got boxes of stuff that supported the data we have. So that's one of the things that's going on right now. They're trying to find all that data. And because we were such a small unit, because this is so long ago, the Pentagon is challenged by finding that. And it is significant to me that they did comment, though, saying that they finally said, yes, we were told about Atta, but, you know, it simply was, in my judgment, from what they said, it was too close to publishing, and they couldn't take the time to actually kind of even investigate what was going on.
Are you concerned, given what happened with the information you gave them, that there are other similar omissions in this report?
Speaking as a private citizen, based on what I've seen, yeah, I would be concerned by the fact that they misrepresented some things I said to them. I mean, I have my notes, so I'm pretty sure of what I said. And the second thing is, yeah, if there were things they were trying, they kind of glazed over here, I would think that there's a possibility, I mean, that something like that happened on other issues.
You are the first military official to publicly discuss this. What made you decide to go public right now?
I lived the last 22 years in the dark. My elk and what we do, we don't come forward. We do our job quietly, and the best things we ever do are never known to the public, and that's the way it needs to be. The problem is that, you know, it comes a point in time where, you know, I think the larger issues of the truth and what really happened and to make sure that fixes are made becomes a key issue. And in this case, I do believe Congress, I believe the administration has done everything it can to really, truly have its heart in the right place and fix things. I think a lot of the barriers which allowed 9/11 to happen have been removed. And if we faced a 9/11 threat today, we'd be able to counter it. The problem is that threat is amorphous and learns quick. It learns our vulnerabilities. It's always looking to find new ways to come after us. And that's what my concern is now. We have the culture that existed before 9/11 still pretty much in place and running things. And although the laws above them have been changed, there's still not, I don't believe, the full tilt, hey, we're at war, let's get this thing done mentality out there. And I don't believe we're using technology to the full benefit either. I think there's still some fear of it, and that's one of the things we're trying to get over here and try to actually bring some capability to the forefront that'll hopefully preclude the next 9/11.
Colonel Schaefer, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate being on.
Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer is an Army Reserve officer who joined us on the line from Washington, D.C. Still to come, a new look at Tom Paine. You're listening to Here and Now. The New York State Athletic Commission this week banned former heavyweight champion Evander Holyfield from fighting in New York, citing diminished skills and performance. Remarkably, the commission also lifted a medical suspension that had prevented Holyfield from fighting elsewhere. Holyfield is 42 years old, and he's won only two of his seven fights since 1999. Only a game's Bill Littlefield spoke with boxing historian and journalist Thomas Hauser. He asked Hauser what message the commission is sending.
What the commission says is this guy has passed all of our tests. His MRIs are fine, his memory is fine, his speech is fine. He's passing all our tests, but he's a shot fighter. In a way, it's like the old Potter Stewart test for obscenity. I know it when I see it.
Shouldn't the fact that Holyfield, at age 42, wants to keep fighting be considered evidence of a serious decline in his decision-making ability?
No. You know, people do what they want to do if the law lets them, and there's really a threshold issue to all that, and it's applicable to Evander Holyfield, Joe Macy, and many other fighters. Riddick Bowe's another one who shouldn't be in the ring anymore. And that is, if you have a fighter who comes in and says, yeah, I know I'm at increased risk, but it's my life. Who are you to say I can't fight anymore? And the answer to that is that boxing is legalized assault. It involves an activity that would not otherwise be allowed, but the state allows it to happen within certain rules and regulations. So a license to fight is a privilege, not a right. The state can protect people from themselves in the ring the same way they do with people who want to jump off bridges and commit suicide. And within that guideline, I personally don't think Evander Holyfield should be fighting anymore. He had a long and glorious career in the ring, but he's only going to get hurt now. Evander says he knows the risks and he can take care of himself inside a boxing ring, but that's the same thing Muhammad Ali said.
Often when one state bans a fight will almost immediately be announced in another state. That hasn't happened yet in this case. I'm wondering if that's a sign that other states will follow New York's lead.
It's not a sign that other states will follow New York's lead, because most of them won't. It's a sign of the precipitous drop in Evander's drawing power. Evander was paid $8 million when he fought Buster Douglas for the heavyweight championship of the world in the 1990s, the early 1990s. For his last fight against Larry Donald, he got under $1 million, and his numbers are going down now. So the reason you haven't heard it announced that, Evander Holyfield's fighting in Memphis or Evander Holyfield is fighting in one of the Gulf Coast casinos is that so far nobody in the United States has put up the money for an Evander Holyfield fight in an amount that would satisfy him.
Holyfield's manager has announced that he will try to get Holyfield a fight in Europe. Why? Does the former heavyweight champion who's made all this money over his glorious career need money now?
I believe that he does. Evander Holyfield hasn't opened up his bank accounts for my scrutiny, but he has a very, very lavish home in Georgia that's quite expensive to maintain. There have been several costly divorces. He has a number of children out of wedlock who he is supporting. He has lost tens of millions of dollars in failed business ventures, such as a Christian broadcasting network, and for a while there was a serious gambling problem. So Evander is not poor by your standards or my standards, but he certainly doesn't have the financial resources that he once did, but he never will again, because the days of Evander being able to command $20 million or fight are gone now.
I'm not sure I want to hear the answer to this question, but do you think Evander Holyfield will be fighting somewhere soon?
I would think that sometime within the next 6 months we'll see Evander Holyfield in the ring again. And it's a shame. Evander Holyfield was once a great fighter. He was a true warrior who embodied everything that was good about boxing and the ring. And now he represents some of the worst things about the business of boxing.
Thomas Hauser is the author of Chaos, Corruption, Courage, and Glory, A Year in Boxing. He spoke with Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. As a writer, as a journalist, Thomas Paine played a key role in drawing public opinion toward the idea of American independence with his work Common Sense in 1776. But a new book argues that his contribution was not limited to writing or the revolutionary times in which he lived. The book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, traces Paine's influence on radicals and rebels throughout the course of the country's history. Harvey Kay is a professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and he's the author of the book and joins us now to discuss a man who's not often included when the founding fathers, Adams, Jefferson, and Washington are mentioned. Professor Kay, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be talking to you.
You say that Thomas Paine should be considered among the founding fathers. Why so?
Well, he should be considered perhaps the founding father, if you don't mind my saying so. And the reason is that he not only called for independence, publicly called for independence before anyone else, but in the course of doing that, he laid out a vision of what America was to become, which I would argue is the vision that we most readily embrace even today. And that when folks debate Jefferson versus Hamilton and whose America we've become, I think what we really want to consider is the degree to which we've become Thomas Paine's America and the degree to which perhaps we have not.
Take us back to that time and remind us what people were thinking. You know, we have this sort of the standard idea that a third of Americans were Tories, a third were ambivalent, mm-hmm. and only a third wanted independence. What was the vision before the notion of independence really caught hold?
Before the notion of independence caught hold, Americans thought of themselves as British Americans. In fact, even those who weren't British, the German and French Americans thought of themselves as British and were proud to be so. They believed the empire was the greatest empire since the world had begun, and they thought that within that empire they shared an identity that involved liberties and understandings that nowhere else in the world possessed. And yet, here they were at war in 1774 and 1775, especially with that British Empire, challenging colonialism. And Paine, who came to America in very late 1774 from Britain, carrying a certain kind of anger with him about British life, came to America and found this an unbelievably wonderful place, a place of great opportunities and great possibilities. And he often spoke of those things, and he started to imagine an America that would be independent, an America that would be an asylum for mankind, an America that would represent a model to the world for the extension of freedom, equality, and democracy. And this leads him to Common Sense, so that he offers a vision of America, and he actually articulates an identity for Americans of what they will become. Call it exceptionalism. Many people don't like to speak of exceptionalism any longer, but Paine had an understanding that America was to be exceptional and really represent possibilities for humanity that the world had never before seen.
You point out in the book, of course, that he's an immigrant, which is something I hadn't been aware of. I mean, the fact that he was a recent immigrant from Great Britain, from
only
England.
A year had he been in the States before this pamphlet appears.
How important is it, do you think, that he was an immigrant? Did that play a part in how he... First of all, how he understood the potential for America and how he was received as a propagandist, as a writer.
It took someone who didn't already live within it, perhaps, to see the possibilities within it. There were two of the founding fathers who stand out as immigrants, Paine and Hamilton, both visionaries, though radically different kind of visionaries. And the other thing about Paine is that he himself came from a working class background, and he had a genius with a pen and a sensibility and a sensitivity as a working man, which combined and drawing upon the anger of a former British subject and the sense of possibility as an American, which enabled him to articulate and bring together very diverse people to support what would become the American Revolution, to turn a colonial rebellion into a revolution, as he said, to begin the world over again.
And those ideas, that vision, was most clearly expressed in Common Sense, was it not?
Common Sense, even to this day, I think Common Sense is one of the greatest, not just the greatest pamphlet in American history, but one of the greatest documents of American history. There would have been no Declaration of Independence had it not been for Common Sense. Because Common Sense, which appears in January of 1776, that winter and that spring became one of the greatest bestsellers ever in American history. And Paine himself took no royalties from it. Any profits that accrued went to buy mittens for Washington's troops. And it spread from South Carolina and Georgia all the way up to New England, and bit by bit, Americans started thinking of themselves no longer as British, but indeed as Americans with a kind of historical purpose and promise that they had to fulfill.
Let's move on a bit and talk about his influence today in American politics, or through the years, I suppose, if we can take a look at that. Abraham Lincoln, for instance, you say when Lincoln spoke of better angels of our nature at the end of his first inaugural address, he had Paine in mind.
I found that in Lincoln's later speeches and writings, there's an echo of Paine. Now, most biographers of Lincoln say that Lincoln had a particular affection for Jefferson and the founders and really looked at the Declaration of Independence with tremendous, you know, with tremendous fervor. But I would argue that I think Lincoln not only picked up the religious spirit of Paine early in his life at New Salem, but also picked up the kind of democratic spirit. And I think that when we listen to the speeches such as the Gettysburg Address, we're really hearing echoes of Paine's understanding of what America needs to become.
How do you think Thomas Paine would critique America today?
Well, if we were to resurrect Paine, I have no doubt that on one hand he'd be terribly impressed by the talk of freedom. But he would also be rather shattered by the idea that the United States had not cultivated a democratic alliance to pursue the kinds of aspirations that he envisioned America doing. He said, look, the United States and the American people had an obligation not only to themselves to create freedom, equality, and democracy, but to represent a model to the world and indeed to support movements around the world. And one might well wonder about, you know, one would wonder, well, what about Iraq? That's the question that people ask me. And I say, you know, there's no doubt about what Paine would have done. Paine would have sent George Bush the first all the way to Baghdad to take out Saddam Hussein at that time. Would he have supported this war? In spirit, in some ways, he would have, but he would not have supported the manner in which the war was originally pursued and continues to be pursued.
Would that have to do with who's actually in control, who's benefiting? I mean, would he see
horrified by the profiteering that he would imagine is taking place today. Paine himself, during the Revolution, spoke openly about the ways in which certain people were seeking to make tremendous profits from the Revolutionary War. He actually was one of the first whistleblowers regarding the commerce and aid from France to the United States and who was trying to, you know, benefit themselves from that.
Do you get a sense now that Thomas Paine is being rehabilitated in the eyes of American history?
Well, absolutely. In fact, the curious thing is I actually start the book with Ronald Reagan, which a lot of people find very shocking and surprising. But I remember being shocked and surprised when Ronald Reagan quoted Thomas Paine at the Republican National Convention in 1980. Paine, at his most radical, Reagan quoted, he said, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." And what Reagan grasped was that Paine's words spoke to Americans. And as much as Paine was a conservative, he was a new kind of conservative, a conservative who knew that Americans were essentially progressives. And Reagan himself had started out as a progressive, as a New Deal progressive. And he held on to that kind of spirit, and he knew how to articulate it, at least rhetorically.
Harvey Kaye, thank you very much.
Thank you. I love talking about Thomas Paine.
Harvey Kaye is the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. He teaches social change and development at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay.
As I went out one morning to breathe the air around Tom Paine's, I spied the
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stacio. Join us again here and now.
I offered her my hand. She took me by the arm. I knew that very instant she meant to do me.
For a cassette
harm.
Or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stacio. Join us next